This is Audible.
Twice Bitten, a Chicagoland Vampires novel. By Chloe Neal. Narrated by Cynthia Holloway. Copyright 2010 by Chloe Neal. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with New American Library, a division of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2010 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Chapter 1. Join the Club. Early June, Chicago, Illinois. It was the beginning of Route 66, the spot where America's Main Street began to traverse the United States. Buckingham Fountain, the heart of Grant Park, was named for the brother of the woman who donated the fountain to the city of Chicago. By day, the fountain's main jet shot 150 feet into the air, a tower of water between the expanse of Lake Michigan and the expanse of downtown Chicago. But it was late now, and the jets had been turned off for the night. The park was officially closed, but that didn't stop a handful of stragglers from walking around the fountain or perching on the steps that led down to Lakeshore Drive to take in the view of the dark and gleaming waters of Lake Michigan. I checked my watch. It was 8 minutes after midnight. I was here because someone had been leaving me anonymous notes. The first ones mentioned invitations. The last one had invited me to the fountain at midnight, which meant the mysterious someone was 8 minutes late. I had no clue who had invited me or why, but I was curious enough to make the drive downtown from my home in Hyde Park. I was also cautious enough to show up with a weapon, a short, pearl-handled dagger that was strapped beneath my suit jacket on my left side. The dagger had been a gift from Master Vampire Ethan Sullivan to me, the sentinel of his House of Vampires. I probably didn't look the part of the stereotypical vampire, as the Cadogan house uniform, a slim-fit, well-tailored black pantsuit, wasn't exactly the stuff of horror movies. My long, straight, dark hair was pulled into its usual high ponytail, dark bangs across my forehead. I donned a pair of black Mary Jane-style heels, which, my preference for Pumas notwithstanding, looked pretty good with the suit. My beeper was clipped to my waist in case of house emergencies. As house sentinel, I usually carried a katana, 30-odd inches of honed steel. But for this meeting, I'd left my katana at home, thinking the sight of a blood-red scabbard strapped to my side might inspire a bit too much attention from human eyes. I was, after all, in the park after hours. The members of the Chicago Police Department were going to be curious enough about that. A 3-foot-long samurai sword wasn't going to instill much confidence that I was here only for introductions and conversation. And speaking of introductions, "I wasn't sure you'd come," a voice suddenly said from behind me. I turned, my eyes widening at the vampire who'd addressed me. Noah? More specifically, it was Noah Beck, leader of Chicago's rogue vampires, the ones not tied to a particular house. Noah was bulky, broad shoulders topping a muscular frame. His brown hair stood up in spiky whorls. His eyes were blue, and tonight his jaw bore a trace of stubble. Noah wasn't cover model handsome, but with the build, strong jaw, and slightly crooked nose, he could fill the leading role in an action movie with no problems. He was dressed as he usually was, in unrelieved black. Black cargo pants, black boots, and a snug, ribbed black t-shirt to replace the long-sleeved version he'd worn in cooler weather. "You asked to meet me?" "I did," he said. When a few seconds passed without elaboration, I tilted my head at him. "Why not just call me and ask for a meeting?" Or better yet, I thought, why not call Ethan? He was usually more than willing to send me into the arms of needy vampires. Noah crossed his arms over his chest, his expression so serious that his down-thrust chin nearly touched his shirt. "Because you belong to Sullivan, and this meeting isn't about him. It's about you. If I'd signed those notes, I figure you would have felt obliged to tell him about the meet. I belong to Cadogan House, I clarified, making it known that I didn't, contrary to popular opinion, belong to Ethan. Not that I hadn't considered it. That means I can't guarantee I won't spill whatever you tell me, I added, letting a small smile curl my lips. But that depends on what you tell me. Noah uncrossed his arms, slipped a hand into one of his pants pockets, and pulled out a thin red card. Holding the card between two fingers, he extended it toward me. I knew what it would say before I took it from him. It would bear the initials RG and the white stamp of a flower-like fleur-de-lis. An identical card had been left in my room in the Cadogan House, but I still didn't know what it meant. What's RG? I asked him, returning the card. Noah took it, slipping it back into his pocket. Then he looked around, crooked a finger at me, and began walking toward the lake. Eyebrows raised, I followed him. That was when the history lesson began. The French Revolution was a crucial time for European vampires, he said as we walked down the steps that led from the park to the street below. When the Reign of Terror struck, vampires got caught up in the hysteria, not unlike humans. When the vampires began to turn over their fellow novitiates and masters to the military, when they were guillotined in the street, the members of the Conseil Rouge, the council that governed vampires before the Greenwich Presidium took power, began to panic. That was the second clearing, right? I asked. French vampires squealed about their friends to ensure their own safety. Unfortunately, the vamps they turned over to the mobs were executed. Noah nodded. Exactly. Conseil vampires were old, well-established. They enjoyed their immortality, and they weren't eager to become mob victims. So they organized a group of vampires to protect them. Vampires willing to take aspirin for them. A vampire secret service? That's not a bad analogy, he agreed. The vampires who were asked to serve named themselves the Red Guard. Hence the RG. And since you gave me the card, I'm guessing you're one yourself? A card-carrying member, quite literally. We crossed the street to the lawn in front of the lake, then walked across the grass to the concrete shoreline. When we stopped, I glanced over at Noah, wondering why I was getting the history lesson and the details on his secret life. Okay, interesting history lesson, but what does all this have to do with me? Impatient, are you? I cocked an eyebrow. I agreed to a secret midnight meeting you didn't want my master to know about. You're actually getting profound restraint. Noah smiled back slowly, wolfishly, his lips gradually spreading to reveal straight white teeth and needle-sharp fangs. Why, Merritt, I'm surprised you haven't guessed yet. I'm here to recruit you. It was a full minute before he spoke again. In the meantime, we stood in silence, the two of us staring out at the lake and the bobbing lights of sailboats near the shore. I'm not sure what he was thinking about, but I was contemplating his offer. Things have changed since the RG was founded, Noah finally said, his voice booming in the darkness. We make sure the Presidium doesn't overstep its authority, like a check and balance on the power of the GP. We also ensure the balance of power between masters and novitiates stay relatively stable. Sometimes we investigate. On rare occasions, we clean up. So, to summarize, Noah wanted me to join an organization whose main goal was keeping master vampires and GP members from having too much power, or from using that power indiscriminately. An organization whose members spied on their masters. I blew out a slow breath, something tightening in my stomach. I didn't know Ethan's position on the Red Guard, but I had no doubt he would see my joining them as the betrayal of all betrayals. Serving as a Red Guard would put me directly against Ethan, charging me, a novitiate vampire, with watching and judging him. Ethan and I didn't have an easy relationship. Our interactions were an uncomfortable tug-of-war between our being confidants and colleagues, but this went far beyond our usual brand of mutual irritation. In fact, it was exactly the kind of thing Ethan already feared I'd do, spy on the house. He may not have known about the RG invite, but he knew my grandfather, Chuck Merritt, served as a supernatural liaison to the city of Chicago. And he knew my family, the Merritts. Yes, Merritt is my last name. Was connected to Seth Tate, mayor of Chicago. Those ties were close enough to concern him. Involvement in something like this would be the icing on the conniption fit cake. And that begged an interesting question. Why me? I asked Noah. I'm only 2 months old, and I'm not exactly warrior material. You fit our profile, he said. You were made a vampire without consent. Maybe because of that, you seem to have a different kind of relationship with your master. You're a child of wealth, but you've seen its abuses. As Sentinel, you're becoming a soldier, but you've been a scholar. You've sworn your oath to Ethan, but you're skeptical enough not to blindly follow directions. It was a list of traits that probably made Ethan nervous on a daily basis. But Noah seemed convinced they were just the kind of things he was looking for. And what is it exactly that I'd be doing? At this point, we'd like you to be a latent player. You'd remain in Cadogan House, stand sentinel, and stay in communication with your partner. I lifted my eyebrows. My partner? We work in pairs, Noah said, then bobbed his head at something coming behind me. Right on cue. I glanced back, just as the vampire reached us at the shoreline. He was well suited to spying. Even with my improved hearing, I hadn't heard him approach. This vamp was tall and lean, with longish auburn hair that just reached his shoulders, blue eyes set beneath long brows and a chiseled chin. He wore a short-sleeved shirt with a collar, the bottom tucked into his jeans. Tattoos ringed each bicep. A flying angel on one arm, a slinking devil on the other. I wondered what he was conflicted about. The newcomer nodded curtly at me, then looked at Noah. Merritt, Sentinel, Cadogan House, Noah said to him, then glanced at me. Jonah, Guard Captain, Gray House. Guard Captain? I asked aloud, shocked to the core that the captain of Scott Gray's own house guards was also a member of the Red Guard. A vampire in a position of trust, whose purpose in the house was to guard the master, keep him safe. Moonlighting for an organization with an inherent distrust of masterdom. I guessed it wasn't the kind of thing Scott Gray would be thrilled to learn. And seriously, was I channeling Ethan Sullivan or what? If you accept our offer, Noah said, Jonah would be your partner. I looked over at Jonah and found his gaze already on me, his brow furrowed. There was curiosity, but also disdain in his eyes. He apparently wasn't too impressed with what he'd seen so far of the Cadogan Sentinel. But since I wasn't interested in going to war with Ethan and thus had no plans to become Jonah's partner, I managed not to care. I shook my head at Noah. It's too much to ask. I understand your reticence, he said. I know what it means to take the oaths to your house. I've taken them too. But for better or worse, Selena's been released. I lay short odds on our futures being decidedly more violent than our recent past. Not great odds, I solemnly agreed. We'd put an end to the killing spree of Selena de Solanay, former Nevers House master. We'd promised the city of Chicago that she was tucked away in a European dungeon, serving time for arranging those murders, but the GP had put Selena back into circulation. She no longer had control of Nevers House, and she blamed me for that inconvenience. She'd come back to Chicago annoyed about her incarceration and eager for a fight. Noah smiled sadly, as if he understood the direction of my thoughts. The sorcerers have already predicted that war will come, he said. We're afraid that's inevitable. Too many vampires have too much pent-up animosity towards humans to keep peace forever, and vice versa. And Selena has done a bang-up job of rousing them. She plays an unfortunately good martyr. And that doesn't even touch the shifter issue, Jonah pointed out. Shapeshifters and vampires have a long, bloody history, but that's not stopping the packs from heading to Chicago. He glanced at me. Word is, they're meeting this week. That fit with what you've heard? I debated whether I should answer, thus giving away a precious bit of Cadogan House gleaned information, but I opted to tell him. It's not like the info would be kept under wraps for long. Yes, we've heard they'll be here within the week. Reps of all four packs in Chicago, Noah muttered, eyes on the ground. That's like the Hatfields moving in with the McCoys. A centuries-old feud and the warring parties camping out in the same city. It reeks of trouble. He sighed. Look, I'm just asking you to consider it. The only thing we'd ask of you now is a commitment to remain in Cadogan House on standby until... Until, he'd said, as if he believed a coming conflict was inevitable. You'd remain latent until we can't keep the peace any longer. At that point, you'd have to be prepared to join us full-time. You'd have to be prepared to leave the house. I'm sure there was shock in my expression. You'd want me to leave Cadogan House without a sentinel in the middle of a war? Think a little more broadly, Jonah put in. You'd be offering your services, your skills, to all vampires, irrespective of their house affiliation. The RG would offer you a chance to stand for all vampires, not just masters. Not for just Ethan, he meant. I'd no longer be Ethan's sentinel, his vampire. Instead, I'd be a vampire who stood apart from the houses, from the masters, from the Presidium, in order to keep the universe of vampires safe and keep Selena and her rabble-rousers at bay. I wasn't sure what I thought about the request or the RG. I need time to process this, I told them. Noah nodded. This is a serious decision, and it deserves serious consideration. It's about your willingness to step outside your house to ensure all vampires are well protected. How can I reach you? I asked, and wondered whether that question alone meant I'd crossed a line I wouldn't be able to step back from. I'm in the phone book, listed as a security consultant. In the meantime, we haven't spoken, and you've never met Jonah. Tell no one, friends, relatives, colleagues. But consider this merit. Who needs a sentinel more? The vampires of Cadogan House, who have a corps of trained guards and a powerful master at the helm? Or the rest of us? With that, he and Jonah turned and walked away, fading into the darkness of the night. Chapter 2, Fire in the Blood. 1 week later. The intent, I think, was perfectly innocent. We'd been called together, the vampires of Cadogan House, for a demonstration of self-defense techniques. It wasn't unusual that we were training. Vampires were expected to be able to fend for themselves. After all, thousands of years of living beneath the human radar tended to make them a little paranoid. And Ethan and I were enjoying our own, also perfectly innocent, training sessions as I learned to wield my vampire strength. But Ethan decided that circumstances, i.e. Selena, necessitated more training. I hadn't been equipped to take on Selena when she'd shown up at the house a week ago to attack me. And if I, the vampire Ethan was convinced was stronger than most, couldn't do it, he was understandably nervous about the safety of the rest of Cadogan's 319 vampires. So, I'd made the trek from my second-floor room to the sparring room in the basement of Cadogan House. Lindsay, a fellow house guard and my bestest vampire friend, had joined me so we could learn how to better protect ourselves from Chicago's special brand of vampire crazy. We hadn't expected to get a peep show in the bargain. Dear God, Lindsay said breathlessly as we stepped into the sparring room. We stopped at the edge of the tatami mats that covered the floor, lips parted and eyes wide as we surveyed the sight before us. Two vampires in the prime of their immortal lives moved across the floor, muscles flexing as they grappled, barehanded, in attempts to throw the other down. They were sparring without weapons, no swords or steel, using hands and feet, elbows and knees, and the extra physical bite of being a vampire. And they were half naked, Both were sparring barefoot and shirtless, wearing martial arts-style white gi pants, the gleaming gold discs of their Katagon House medals around their necks. Lindsay's gaze was locked on Luke, captain of the Katagon House Guards. Luke was a former cowboy-turned-vampire soldier, complete with broad shoulders, fuzzy chest, and curly, sun-streaked hair that he suddenly stopped to push out of his face, muscles tensing as he moved. Across from Luke was his opponent, Ethan Sullivan, master of Katagon House and the 394-year-old vampire who'd brought me into the world of the Fanged, without my consent, but admittedly because my other option had been a speedy death. He stood a little more than 6 feet tall, and the top half of that 6 feet, the long, lean line of flat stomach and high pecs, along with the trail of blonde hair that dipped down from his navel and disappeared into the waistband of his pants, glistened as he swiveled for a roundhouse kick. Luke, I think, was supposed to be playing the attacker, but Ethan was doing a fine job of holding him off. For all the Armani suits and supermodel good looks, Ethan was a skilled warrior, something I'd been forced to remember when I'd swung my katana at his throat a few nights ago. As I watched him fight, goosebumps pebbled my arms. I assumed my blue irises were shifting to silver as heat began to rise through my body, the fire fanned by the sight of Ethan in motion, dipping and weaving and spinning as he faced down his opponent. I wet my lips, suddenly bloodthirsty, even though I'd had convenience blood bagged by our supplier, Blood for You, less than 24 hours ago. And more important, I'd taken blood directly from a vampire only a week ago. I'd taken blood directly from him. He'd fed me during the final chapter of my transition to vampire, when I'd awoken with a thirst so strong for blood I would have killed to get it. But I hadn't needed violence. Ethan had offered his wrist willingly, and I'd taken full advantage, watching his eyes silver as I took the nutrition that somehow sealed my transformation to predator, to vampire. I smoldered as I watched him, his muscles shifting and flexing as he moved with the slinking grace of a panther. I could have justified the warmth in my belly, called my reaction a consequence of my now fully functioning vampire biology, the result of watching a predator in his prime, or a novitiate's attraction to the master who made her. But that didn't do Ethan Sullivan justice, not even close. He was almost too handsome to be real, with blonde hair framing a gorgeous face, cheekbones that New York models would pay for, eyes that shone like chips of emerald. 6 feet of golden skin stretched taut over muscle, and I could attest that all 6 feet were equally perfect. I caught an accidental glimpse of Ethan as he was satisfying his former mistress, who'd betrayed him to join Selena's band of merry evildoers. It wasn't hard to imagine that he was the top of whatever food chain we belonged to. Not when you watched his long, lean lines move across the room. Not when you watched the tiny bead of sweat that was slowly, ever so slowly, tracing its way down the middle of Ethan's flat abdomen, one brick of muscle at a time, just threatening to slip into the waistband of his pants. To be sure, Ethan felt the attraction as well. He offered to make me his mistress even before Amber decamped to join Team Desaulniers. We'd shared a couple of kisses, but I'd managed to resist taking him up on the rest of his offers. Ethan wanted me, without a doubt, and I wasn't stupid enough to argue his attractiveness, which was undeniable. But Ethan was also completely infuriating, slow to trust, easy to accuse, and still not entirely sure how he felt about me. Not to mention his baggage, his smug sense of superiority and his willingness to use those around him, including me, to meet political goals. There was also the fact that our last kiss had occurred less than 24 hours before I'd broken off my fledgling relationship with Morgan Greer, the vampire who replaced Selena as master of Nevers House. I'd walked away from that kiss with fire in my blood and guilt in my heart. Surely I could find a relationship with a better concoction of emotions. Once I had that thought in mind, my rationality returning, my blood began to cool. It should be illegal for smug vampires to look that good, Lindsay said, clucking her tongue. That is so true, I agreed, thinking a little less hotness would make my relationship with Ethan a lot simpler. I lifted my gaze away from the fighting vampires to scan the rest of the room. The balcony that ringed the sparring room was filled with vampires, men and women. The women, and a few of the men, stared at the action below them, eyes hooded, cheeks flushed, all of them enjoying the sights below. On the other hand, they're the ones creating this spectacle. I slid her a glance, arching an eyebrow. Spectacle? You know, like spectacle. She paused to point at her breasts. But with more dude nipples. Do you agree? I returned my gaze to the master vampire who was currently leaning over to pick up a boken, a wooden practice weapon, from the mat. Muscles clenched and tensed as he moved, nipples pert on his chest. Far be it from me to disagree, I said. They have created quite a spectacle. And when they put it out there like that, they can hardly expect us not to look. Lindsay gave me a nod of approval. I don't know where this bravado comes from, but I like it. I'm trying it on, I whispered back, which was true. The transition to vampire hadn't been easy, psychologically or physically, but I was beginning to get the hang of it. I'd essentially gone through the physical change twice, since the first time around hadn't quite taken. Ethan, in a fit of guilt, had drugged me through the first transition, which apparently forestalled the complete change. That was on top of my move out of the Wicker Park brownstone I'd shared with my former roommate and former best friend and nascent sorceress, Mallory, and into Cadogan House. I'd managed to hold my own when dealing with my parents and their fusty friends, a step I'd taken at Ethan's request when we were trying to keep vampire raves out of the press. And not counting the two times I'd faux-battled Ethan, I managed to subdue Selena approximately 50% of the time she'd come looking for a fight, which wasn't awful, as batting averages went. With that excitement under my belt, here I was, a new vampire in the historic position of sentinel, guarding the house against creatures both living and dead. I'd gone from graduate student to vampire fighter nearly overnight, and now Noah Beck wanted to be the one to capitalize on that. Merit? Merit? Although Lindsay had said my name at least a couple of times, it was the jostling that finally did it, breaking me from the memory of my meeting with Noah and bringing me back to the Cadogan House training room, to Lindsay, who nudged me with her shoulder to get my attention, and to Ethan, who stood before me, hands on his hips, shoulder-length blonde hair tied back, one eyebrow arched condescendingly. Luke was nowhere in sight, and all eyes were on me. Yes? I asked. The vampire snickered. If you're finished with your daydreams, Ethan said into the silence of the room, perhaps you might consider joining me. Sorry, Liege, I muttered, and stepped out of flip-flops and onto the mats, sheathed katana in my hand. I was already in my training ensemble, a black sports bra-type top and yoga pants. I followed Ethan to the middle of the floor, very aware that dozens of vampires were following our movements. He stopped, turned to face me, and bowed. I did the same. It is important, he began, loud enough for all to hear, that you be prepared should the need arise to fight. And to master that fight, you must first master the steps. As you also know, our sentinel hasn't yet mastered the art of sparring. He paused just long enough to give me a pointed look. So sparring wasn't my thing. I was good at the katas, the building blocks of vampire sword fighting. I'd been a ballet dancer, and there was something very dancerly about the moves. They were positions, forms, steps that I could memorize and practice, and, by repetition, perfect. Sparring was different. Having grown up with my nose in a book, I had no experience at fighting beyond a couple of experimental kickboxing classes and a few run-ins with Selena and her assorted minions. I knew my weakness. I spent too much time trying to think through the fight, trying to find an attacker's weaknesses to exploit them, while at the same time trying to keep from overthinking the fight. That had become even harder in the last week, as I'd worked with Luke to keep the cacophony of smells and sounds that threatened, post-change, to overwhelm me, down to a dull roar. "But her work with the Katas is unparalleled." He arched an eyebrow at me, half challenge, half insult, and took a step backward. "Sentinel," he said, his voice lower now, the order just for me. "Katas, if you please." "Liege," I said. I lifted my sword with both hands, my right hand on the handle, left hand on the sheath, and moved my hands apart, unsheathing it with a quick whistle of sound, light glinting from the polished steel. I walked to the edge of the mat and placed the lacquered sheath on the floor beside it. Then, with all the confidence and bravado I could muster, easier now that I'd been asked to join a secret corps of vampire warriors, I returned to him, faced him, and gripped the katana in both hands. "Begin," he ordered, and took steps backward, giving me room. There were 7 two-handed katas and 3 more single-handed moves. Those were new to me. But I'd been practicing the traditional katas since I'd become a vampire, and frankly, I wanted to show off a little. In the week that we'd been working together, Ethan had seen me practice the katas only in traditional fashion, 1 kata at a time, my movements timed and precise. But that wasn't all I could do. I bladed my body, katana poised before me. "Fast or slow?" He frowned. "Fast or slow?" I smiled cannily beneath my fringe of bangs. "Pick your speed." "Vampires?" he asked aloud, but his gaze on me. "Fast or slow?" There were slow stragglers, but the majority requested fast. "Fast, it seems," he said. I nodded, centered my weight, and moved. The first kata brought the sword arching across my body, then returning to the center position. The second was a downward strike. The third and fourth were combinations. The 5th, 6th, and 7th were combinations with spins and parries. In traditional form, when the focus was on precision and control, each kata took 10 or 15 seconds. But done fast, I could work through the entire set in 20 seconds. I'd learned speed from my former trainer, Catcher, a sorcerer with a penchant for katanas and sword fighting. He was also, not coincidentally, Mallory's boyfriend and my grandfather's employee. Catcher demanded I practice the moves over and over, thinking repetition would force the muscle memory. It had, and it had allowed me to use my increased vampire strength, speed, and agility to push the forms into a single dance of movement, so quick my body blurred with the speed of it. After I'd challenged Ethan in our second duel, he decided he needed to supplant Catcher as my trainer. But he didn't know how much Catcher had taught me. I finished the 7th form, spun to a stop, sword between my hands, perpendicular before my body. The lights above us caught the gentle curve of the steel, the entire room suddenly silent. Ethan stared. "Do it again," he said, his words barely audible, a glint in his eyes. I didn't mistake the glint for lust. Although the chemistry between us was keen, Ethan was unambiguously, ubiquitously political, always maneuvering. I was a weapon. I was his weapon. That glint, avarice, pure and simple. "Liege," I said, tilting my head in acknowledgement and returning to the beginning position. I completed the moves again, sword arching perpendicular to the floor, slicing downward. An across and up combination, then the arc and spin combinations, the backward thrust, the overhead strike. I ended in the final position. "Again," he ordered a third time, and I obliged. By the time I'd run through the katas in sequence again, and then done 7 or 8 repetitions of 1 or 2 favorite katas at his request, my chest was heaving with the effort. My hands slippery around the ray skin wrapped handle of my sword. I glanced up and saw that the vampires in the wooden balcony that ringed the training room were leaning forward, arms on the railing, curiosity in their expressions. They tended to look at me that way, either because of my strength as a curiosity or because of my unfortunate habit of challenging Ethan to duels as a freak. For what it's worth, I was really planning on breaking that habit. "Well done," Ethan said quietly, then addressed the balcony. "I believe that answers more than a few questions about our sentinel. And while she's on stage," he tilted his head toward me, "anything our new social chair would like to add about upcoming Katagun events, picnics, mixers?" A blush spread to the roots of my hair. Ethan had named me House Social Chair as punishment for challenging him. As punishments went, it was pretty light. But it was also mortifying, and it took me a moment to get myself together. "I'm thinking about something for summer solstice. A barbecue, probably." "I thought we'd invite vampires from the other houses." The room went silent as Ethan considered the idea, and his audience waited for the verdict. "Good," he finally said with an authoritarian nod, and then looked back at the crowd. His expression changed to something more serious. "We thought at one time," he began, "that our superiors believed assimilation with humans was best. That staying under the radar was the best way to ensure our survival and keep peace with the supernaturals around us. To some extent, Selena has made that impossible. With all due respect to our friends in Nevers House, she has sought at every opportunity to increase our profile, to alienate us from humans, and to alienate us from ourselves." In a rare moment of humanity, Ethan looked down at the ground, worry furrowing a line between his eyes. "We are on the brink," he said. "The brink of what exactly remains to be seen. As it stands, we've been gifted with a time of peace and relative tranquility, a time in which the houses have blossomed financially. But our coming out, by hook or by crook, for better or worse, has put us back in the public eye. A public that hasn't always been kind toward us. Whether our pseudo-celebrity will last, who knows? And now, as you may have heard, the shifters are preparing to meet this week in Chicago. We've been informed that during this convocation, they will decide, for one and all, whether to stay in their respective territories or to return to their ancestral home in Alaska. If they go, and the tide turns against us, well, I don't need to remind you about our shared historical experiences with shifters." There was a mumbling in the crowd, a spike of discomforted magic in the air. Shifters had retreated before when vamps had been in trouble. Vamps blamed shifters for the resulting deaths, and vampires now feared that if the human tide turned against us, shifters would do it again, leaving us here holding the supernatural baggage. "As you know, we don't have formal allies within the packs. They have avoided such ties. But my hope remains that should we face animosity or anger or fear, they will agree to help us." A male vampire stood up. "They've never helped before," he shouted down. Ethan regarded him thoughtfully. "They haven't. But suggesting that they owe us hasn't worked. We will do what we can to form new connections between us. And in the meantime..." He paused, and the room was silent as the vampires waited for his next words. My issues with Ethan notwithstanding, he knew how to work a crowd. "In the meantime," he continued, "I ask you, not as your master, but as your brother, your colleague, your friend. Be careful. Mind the company you keep. Be aware of your surroundings. And most of all, don't be afraid to come to me. Any of you. Anytime." Ethan cleared his throat, and when he spoke again, his voice was crisp, clear, and master-like again. "Dismissed," he said, and the vampires in the balcony began to file out of the sparring room. Ethan walked toward us. "My apartments," he told Luke, then glanced at me. "You too." "Your apartments?" I asked. But Ethan had already turned away, smiling politely at a vampire who'd trekked down from the balcony. I didn't know her, but her goal was obvious enough in the cant of her hip, the subtle play of her fingers as she pushed her long dark hair behind her ears. She leaned toward him and asked something. He laughed and chuckled politely, then began explaining, with visual aids, how to correctly position her hands on the handle of her sword. My lip curled involuntarily, but before I could get out a snarky comment, I felt a tug on my ponytail. I glanced back. "Let's go," Luke said. What did he mean by his apartments? "We have a meeting." The last time we'd had a meeting, Ethan told me about raves, mass feedings in which humans became unwilling vampire snacks. "About the raves?" "Not today," Luke said. "We haven't heard anything else about raves since the attempt to blackmail us went bad. Leek's working up a long-term strategy. Today, we're talking shifters. Let's go." "Unless you want to keep watching." I stuck out my tongue at him, but I followed when he headed for the door. The basement of Cadogan House was all business, most of it violent. Training room, sparring room, ops room, arsenal. The first floor, like the second and third, was about decor. Soft lighting, French antiques, hardwoods, expensive furniture. 5-star hotel had been my first impression. The rest of the rooms were equally fancy, from Ethan's masculine office to his luxe apartments. We took the central staircase to the third floor. When we reached Ethan's apartments, Luke grasped the handles of the double doors in both hands, then pushed them open. I'd been in Ethan's rooms before, but only briefly. As far as I could tell, Ethan's chunk of the third floor had three rooms: the main living room, the bedroom, and presumably a bathroom somewhere in the back. It was as elegantly appointed as the rest of the house, from the hardwood floors to the warmly painted walls, from the onyx fireplace to the expensive tailored furniture. It looked more like a suite in a fine hotel than the home of a vampire in the prime of his immortal life. This trip, I gave the room a careful look, scanning for hints into the psyche of the master of the house. And there were plenty of details to peruse. The detritus of his 400 years of life dotted the room. A bow and arrow hung on one wall. A campaign chair and desk that looked like it would fold for travel, maybe remnants of Ethan's time as a soldier, sat in one corner. A low buffet-styled chest was centered on another wall, a spread of objects on top of it. I ambled over, hands behind my back, and surveyed the goods. There were two silver trophies styled like giant cups, a picture of men in early 19th century garb, but no Ethan amongst them, and a flat stone with symbols carved into the top. After I'd given them a once-over, I glanced up and checked out the rest of the room. That was when I spied it in a corner. In one corner, inside a tall glass case, sat a gleaming Fabergé egg. "Oh, wow," I said, walking toward it to get a better look. A pendant light shone above it, illuminating the lustrous spring-green enamel and the snarling golden dragon that wound around it. "It was Peter's," Luke said. I glanced back at him. "Peter's?" "Peter Cadogan." Luke walked toward me, arms crossed, then gestured toward the glass case. "The master vampire who founded Cadogan House. It was a gift from a member of the Russian royalty." He tapped a finger on the glass. "Peter was from Wales, and it's a representation of the Welsh dragon. See the eye?" I nodded at where he pointed. A round red gem was placed at the dragon's eye. Six white lines radiated from its middle. "It's a star ruby," he said. "Incredibly rare." "And incredibly expensive," added a voice behind us. We both stood straight again and glanced around. Ethan walked in, still in his gi pants, around his neck a navy towel bearing a silver monogrammed C. "Shower," he said. "Make yourselves at home." Ethan walked toward the doors that led to his bedroom. He opened one, slipped inside, and closed it behind him again. "I could have used a shower," I pointed out.
I know. I can smell you from here.
I was halfway to discreetly sniffing my armpit before I realized he was just trying to rile me up.
You're funny. You're easy. You were telling me about the egg?
Oh, Luke said, then scratched absently at his temple. So Peter met this Russian duchess and they bonded, completely platonic from what I understand. But he did her a favor of some kind. She wanted to repay him, so she commissioned the egg and threw in the ruby for good measure.
I suppose it pays to have friends, I concluded,
then dropped my tone to something a little more serious. Speaking of Peter's, any developments on a replacement for our former colleague? Peter Spencer had been excommunicated from the house for betraying us to Selena, for assisting in her blackmail plans and her ploys to create more anti-shifter fervor amongst vamps, and anti-Cadogan fervor amongst humans. Luke busied himself by picking at a bit of dust on the egg's glass case.
Not really ready to talk about that, Sentinel.
I nodded, not entirely surprised by Luke's reaction. He'd punched a divot into the ops room conference table when he'd discovered Peter's treachery. The hole had been repaired, but the table hadn't yet been refinished. It was like a stain marking Peter's betrayal. And it wasn't surprising Luke wasn't eager to invest in someone else. I wanted to say something, to offer my condolences or even a simple, I'm sorry. But a knock on the hallway doors stopped me short.
Preparations for our guest,
Luke said as the doors were opened by a man in a white chef's jacket. He smiled politely at Luke and me, and then moved aside so that a second chef, this time a woman in white, could wheel a cart into the room. The cart was piled with trays, and the trays were topped by silver domes. It was room service. What guest? I asked as, with hotel-like efficiency, the woman began removing the domes and stacking them one atop the other. She revealed a spread of food. Crackers, cheeses, a rainbow of fruit, from lush berries to slices of buttercup yellow mango to spring green coins of kiwi, and tiny sausages speared by toothpicks. I had a pang. Mallory loved those things. But we were still on the outs, and thinking about her still hurt. So for now, I focused my attention back on the movable feast. And the tray of small pastries arranged around a poppy seed dotted pink dip.
The guest is Gabriel Keane, Luke said. He's dropping by to talk to your liege and mine.
I gave him a soft snort. I assume that means you're involving me in shifter shenanigans this week.
I'm surprised at you, Sentinel.
Ethan walked back into the sitting room. He was in black suit pants and a white button-up, no tie. The top button was unbuttoned, and he'd skipped the suit coat. Luke and I were still in workout gear, so it was practically business casual in here today.
We so rarely involve you in shenanigans, Ethan said, then nodded at the woman who'd wheeled in the cart. Thank you, Alicia. My compliments to the chef.
Alicia smiled, then collected her stack of steel covers. She turned and left the room, and the man who'd held open the doors gave us a final smile before he walked out again, closing the doors behind him.
You involve me in shenanigans at every opportunity.
She has a point, Liege.
Ethan clucked his tongue.
Captain of my guards, and he carries the standard of my sentinel. Oh, how quickly they turn. You're first in my heart, Liege.
This time Ethan snorted.
We'll see. Well, at any rate, we'll see where Gabriel's allegiances lie.
He looked over the trays before nabbing a bottle of water, twisting off the top and taking a drink.
Nice spread, I told him.
He nodded. I thought it polite to offer Gabriel something to eat, and I assumed I'd have a greater chance of keeping your attention if I fed you first.
I'd have to give him that one. I love to eat. And the non-stop vampire metabolism hadn't done much to dampen my appetite. Quite the opposite.
Let's just remember, Sullivan, that I want you for your smoked meats and your smoked meats only.
He barked out a laugh.
Touché, Sentinel. I grinned at him, then plucked a piece of cheese from the tray and popped it in my mouth. It was rich and earthy, but it had that weird aftertaste that fancy cheeses always seem to have. "So," I began, after I nabbed a couple more chunks for good measure, "why is Gabriel coming to the house?"
"You'll recall he wanted to speak about security arrangements for the convocation."
I nodded. Gabriel had mentioned it when he dropped by a week ago.
"As it turns out, you were the security arrangement."
I blanched. "I'm the security arrangement? What does that mean?"
Ethan took another drink before recapping the bottle.
"It means, Sentinel, that we're throwing you to the wolves."
Chapter 3. Hide and Seek.
"I've loaned you to Gabriel," he added by way of explanation.
I could only blink. "I'm sorry. It sounded like you said you've loaned me to Gabriel."
"Well, well," said a voice at the threshold. "Aren't I lucky to be getting a loner sentinel?"
Without so much as a sound, Gabriel Keen, apex of the North American Central Pack of Shapeshifters, had made his way into Ethan's apartments. He stood in the doorway, hands still on the knobs, light from the hallway spilling around him into the room. Gabe walked inside, then shut the doors behind him.
"Your second in command ushered me up. I told him no introductions were necessary."
"Gabriel,"
Ethan said, extending a hand and walking toward him. Gabriel shook it, his heavy black boots clunking on the hardwood floors as he moved. They were an interesting contrast. Ethan, blonde, rangy, and dressed in a crisp shirt and suit pants. Gabriel, tousled brown hair, broad-shouldered, and dressed in jeans and a black t-shirt. Ethan was no slouch, but Gabriel was just so masculine, and all that shifter energy practically sucked the air from the room. I considered his very pregnant wife, Tanya, a very lucky girl. When he and Ethan had finished their manly handshaking, Gabriel looked over at me.
"What's the going rate for a loner sentinel these days?"
"Patience," said Luke and Ethan at the same time. A hint of a smile crossed Gabriel's face. I rolled my eyes.
"You remember Luke, captain of my guards," Ethan said, gesturing toward Luke. "And Merritt, of course."
Gabriel nodded at each of us in turn.
"Help yourself to the food," Ethan said, extending an arm toward the cart.
Gabriel shook his head, then gestured toward one of Ethan's tailored sofas.
"Can I sit?"
Ethan nodded graciously, then joined Gabriel at the seating area. Luke followed. I grabbed a cracker and did the same, but sat cross-legged on the floor.
"Just finished training," I told Gabriel with an apologetic smile, then pointed at the empty Louis XIV chair besides Luke's.
"I'd prefer not to get a lecture about ruining the antiques."
"My sentinel is currently high on a mix of cheese and carbohydrates," Ethan chummily told Gabriel.
"Respectfully, I'd ignore her if I were you."
"I'll leave that job to you. Perhaps we should get to the point."
"Feel free." Gabriel frowned, then crossed his right ankle over his left knee.
"It might be best if I started at the beginning. Shifters are an independent bunch. I don't mean that we live a solitary existence, quite the opposite. We are organized into packs, after all, but we tend to live in the margins of human society. Vamps tend to think of us as a tent and jeep crew, a hog and Harley crew, a rock and roll and straight Jack Daniels crew."
Although I'd heard that description, the only shifters I knew, other than Gabe, Jeff Christopher, a shifter-slash-computer genius and one of my grandfather's employees, and Chicago's Breckenridge family, who were as rich and well-heeled as they came, were exactly the opposite. On the other hand, the Brecks had tried to blackmail us. Gabriel shrugged, and his voice softened a bit.
"That description isn't entirely untrue, and that means that from a temperament standpoint, pack members are generally uninterested in humans, in other sups. They aren't interested in strategy."
"What are they interested in?" Luke asked.
"Family," Gabriel said. "Their families, their children, the unity of the packs. They're loyal. And to a one, they'll follow as the pack decides. But that attitude can make them, let's say, insular.
Ethan wet his lips, as if preparing to broach an uncomfortable subject.
There have been rumblings about the packs returning home to Aurora. Aurora was the ancestral home Ethan had mentioned earlier, a remote town in the wilds of northern Alaska. From what I understood, it was where shifters congregated when they needed to get away from human machinations. It was also a place to hide out, to disappear when things got rowdy, or when vampires got into trouble. It was their collective retreat when the supernatural life got too sticky. I'd been a vampire for less than 3 months. The drama was occasionally overwhelming, so I understood the urge to retreat. But I wasn't thrilled about the idea of being left behind. To his credit, Gabriel managed not to squirm under Ethan's scrutinizing stare. But a low wash of magic filled the room, like a silent growl, unpleasantly acerbic. I fought the urge to roll my shoulders against the uncomfortable tingle. I also opened the telepathic communication between Ethan and me to offer up a silent warning. "He's getting angry," I told him. "Tread carefully."
"I'm willing to test the waters," Ethan answered back.
That answer was surprising. Ethan was generally strategically conservative. I also used to think only he could trigger the connection between us. Apparently, he'd just been ignoring me.
"My intent is to have the packs convene. The ultimate decision on that will be made by the pack leaders. But assuming that conversation goes well, we'll convene, and we'll decide whether to remain among humans or return to the woods. And if the pack decides that, we go," Gabriel weightily added. "Then we go."
"Why now?" Ethan asked.
"We know the sorcerers are beginning to see things, that prophecies are beginning to bubble up. Prophecies of war, of coming battles."
Ethan nodded.
We'd heard Catcher offer up just such a prophecy.
"Have you heard talk about underground groups?"
Ethan leaned forward.
"What underground groups?"
Gabriel donned the expression of a man about to impart bad news.
"Anti-fang groups, humans who think vampires showing themselves is the first sign of some coming apocalypse.
Or the Second American Civil War."
Ethan went quiet.
"We hadn't heard that," Luke put in. "No rumbles, no chatter. Like I said, the movement is still underground. We've heard about meetings in eastern Tennessee, but it sounds like they're still rural, publicized by word of mouth, handwritten flyers, that kind of thing. But sooner or later, they'll go electronic. We'd prefer not to be here when that happens."
Ethan sat back in his chair, but not before sharing a meaningful glance with Luke. I assumed they were talking silently about some strategy for getting information on the anti-fang groups.
"You'll understand my concern," Ethan said, "about your leaving. If you take your numbers, your skills, your power, if you merge back into the wild, then you leave us here."
"Alone" was the word Ethan didn't say. Alone against a tide of human opinion that was, if Gabriel was right about the underground rumblings, already beginning to shift against us.
Gabriel shook his head. "If we stay, what's to become of us? I understand your fear."
Ethan held up a hand, stopping him.
"With all due respect, Gabriel, you don't understand our fear."
That caused another spike of adrenaline, this time emanating from Ethan's direction. Tensions were rising. The collective burden of years of animosity between these two men and the people they sought to protect. Gabriel stood, then paced to one end of the room. He leaned back against the far wall, putting space between himself and the rest of us, then raised his gaze to us again.
"You're lucky in a sense that humans think they understand vampires. They may have believed you were myth, but they also believed they understood your biology. Humans have alternately sought to join you or to exterminate you. But us? We'd be seen as animals, research subjects."
Although Catcher had once told me that Jeff could handle himself, I had the suddenly ferocious urge to find and embrace him,
to ensure that he was safe from anyone who'd try to do him harm.
If we stay, Gabriel said, his gaze on the floor, then outing ourselves or being outed is inevitable, and nothing pleasant would follow. The weight of his words hung in the ensuing silence.
Then perhaps, Ethan said after a moment, it's time we come to understand each other as we are, without unrealistic expectations between us.
I'm not sure we can clear the slate, Gabriel said. Too much history.
I saw the quick flare of disappointment in Ethan's eyes, and my heart clenched. I also saw my opportunity, so I took it. I stood up, then glanced between them and used a little of that speechifying technique Ethan was so very good at.
We have a window of opportunity, I told them, then looked at Ethan. The majority of humans, at least for today, think vampires are cool.
The animosity may be building again, but for today, we're safe.
Then I turned to Gabriel. If this convocation happens, it will be to talk, right?
To decide what to do?
At his nod, I continued. Then you have time to make a decision. You have the luxury to chart a course, instead of just reacting to a crisis, when stepping away to protect your people feels like the only real option.
I paused for a moment, blinking as I figured out what to say next.
When nothing flowery came to mind, I just told the truth.
I don't envy either of you in the decision of what to do next. And I haven't been a vampire long enough to have